When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 13 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Olsey, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 13. Reflections. It seemed indeed as if the incident were finally closed, the chief actors in the drama having deliberately vacated the center of the stage. The little crowd which had stood in a compact mass round the table began to break up into sundry small groups. Laughter and desultory talk, checked for a moment by that oppressive sense of unknown danger which had weighed on the spirits of those present, once more became general. Blakeney's light-heartedness had put everyone into good humour. Since he evidently did not look upon the challenge as a matter of serious moment, why then no one else had any cause for anxiety, and the younger men were right glad to join in that bowl of punch which their genial host had offered with so merry a grace. Lackeys appeared, throwing open the doors. From a distance the sound of dance music once more broke upon the ear. A few of the men only remained silent, deliberately holding aloof from the renewed mirthfulness. Foremost amongst these was His Royal Highness, who was looking distinctly troubled, and who had taken Sir Percy by the arm, and was talking to him with obvious earnestness. Lord Antony Dewhurst and Lord Hastings were holding converse in a secluded corner of the room, whilst Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, as being the host's most intimate friend, felt it incumbent on him to say a few words to ex-ambassador Chauvelin. The latter was desirous of effecting a retreat. Blakeney's invitation to join in the friendly bowl of punch could not be taken seriously, and the terrorist wanted to be alone in order to think out the events of the past hour. A lackey waited on him, took the momentous sword from his hand, found his hat and cloak, and called his coach for him. Chauvelin, having taken formal leave of his host and acquaintances, quickly worked his way to the staircase and hall, through the less frequented apartments. He sincerely wished to avoid meeting Lady Blakeney face to face. Not that the slightest twinge of remorse disturbed his mind, but he feared some impulsive action on her part, which indirectly might interfere with his future plans. Fortunately, no one took much heed of the darkly clad, insignificant little figure that glided so swiftly by, obviously determined to escape attention. In the hall he found Demoiselle Candet waiting for him. She too had evidently been desirous of leaving Blakeney Manor as soon as possible. He saw her to her chaise, then escorted her as far as her lodgings, which were close by. There were still one or two things which he wished to discuss with her, one or two final instructions which he desired to give. On the whole he was satisfied with this evening's work. The young actress had well supported him, and had played her part so far with marvellous sang-froid and skill. Sir Percy, whether willingly or blindly, had seemed only too ready to walk into the trap which was being set for him. This fact alone disturbed Chauvelin not a little, and as half an hour or so later, having taken final leave of his ally, he sat alone in the coach which was conveying him back to town, the sword of Lorenzo Cenci close to his hand, he pondered very seriously over it. That the adventurous Scarlet Pimpernel should have guessed all along that sooner or later the French revolutionary government, whom he had defrauded of some of its most important victims, would desire to be even with him and to bring him to the scaffold was not to be wondered at. But that he should be so blind as to imagine that Chauvelin's challenge was anything else but a lure to induce him to go to France could not possibly be supposed. So bold an adventurer, so keen an intriguer, was sure to have scented the trap immediately, and if he appeared ready to fall into it, it was because there had already sprung up in his resourceful mind some bold coup or subtle counterplan with which he hoped to gratify his own passionate love of sport, whilst once more bringing his enemies to discomfiture and humiliation. Undoubtedly, Sir Percy Blakeney, as an accomplished gentleman of the period, could not very well, under the circumstances which had been so carefully stage-managed and arranged by Chauvelin, refuse the latter's challenge to fight him on the other side of the Channel. Any hesitation on the part of the leader of that daring Scarlet Pimpernel League would have covered him with a faint suspicion of pusillanimity, and a subtle breath of ridicule, and in a moment the prestige of the unknown and elusive hero would have vanished forever. But apart from the necessity of the fight, Blakeney seemed to enter into the spirit of the plot directed against his own life with such light-hearted merriment, such zest and joy, that Chauvelin could not help but be convinced that the capture of the Scarlet Pimpernel at Boulogne or elsewhere would not prove quite so easy a matter as he had at first anticipated. That same night he wrote a long and circumstantial letter to his colleague Citizen Robespierre, shifting thereby, as it were, some of the responsibility of coming events from his own shoulders onto the executive of the Committee of Public Safety. "I guarantee to you, Citizen Robespierre," he wrote, "and to the members of the revolutionary government who have entrusted me with the delicate mission, that 4 days from this date, at 1 hour after sunset, the man who goes by the mysterious name of the Scarlet Pimpernel will be on the ramparts of Boulogne, on the south side of the town. I have done what has been asked of me. On that day and at that hour I shall have brought the enemy of the revolution, the intriguer against the policy of the Republic, within the power of the government which he has flouted and outraged. Now look to it, citizens all, that the fruits of my diplomacy and of my skill be not lost to France again. The man will be there at my bidding. 'Tis for you to see that he does not escape this time." This letter he sent by special courier which the National Convention had placed at his disposal in case of emergency. Having sealed it and entrusted it to the man, Chauvelin felt at peace with the world and with himself. Although he was not so sure of success as he would have wished, he yet could not see how failure could possibly come about. And the only regret which he felt tonight, when he finally, in the early dawn, sought a few hours' troubled rest, was that that momentous fourth day was still so very far distant. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 14. The Ruling Passion. In the meanwhile, silence had fallen over the beautiful old manorial house. One by one the guests had departed, leaving that peaceful sense of complete calm and isolation which follows the noisy chatter of any great throng bent chiefly on enjoyment. The evening had been universally acknowledged to have been brilliantly successful. True, the much-talked-of French artiste had not sung the promised ditties, but in the midst of the whirl and excitement of dances, of the inspiring tunes of the stirring band, the elaborate supper and recherche wines, no one had paid much heed to this change in the programme of entertainments. And everyone had agreed that never had Lady Blakeney looked more radiantly beautiful than on this night. She seemed absolutely indefatigable, a perfect hostess, full of charming little attentions towards everyone, although more than ordinarily absorbed by her duties towards her many royal guests. The dramatic incidents which had taken place in the small boudoir had not been much bruited abroad. It was always considered bad form in those courtly days to discuss men's quarrels before ladies, and in this instance those who were present when it all occurred instinctively felt that their discretion would be appreciated in high circles, and held their tongues accordingly. Thus the brilliant evening was brought to a happy conclusion without a single cloud to mar the enjoyment of the guests. Marguerite performed a veritable miracle of fortitude, forcing her very smiles to seem natural and gay, chatting pleasantly, even wittily, upon every known fashionable topic of the day, laughing merrily the while her poor aching heart was filled with unspeakable misery. Now, when everybody had gone, when the last of her guests had bobbed before her the prescribed curtsy, to which she had invariably responded with the same air of easy self-possession, now at last she felt free to give rein to her thoughts, to indulge in the luxury of looking her own anxiety straight in the face, and to let the tension of her nerves relax. Sir Andrew Ffoulkes had been the last to leave, and Percy had strolled out with him as far as the garden gate, for Lady Ffoulkes had left in her chaise some time ago, and Sir Andrew meant to walk to his home, not many yards distant from Blakeney Manor. In spite of herself, Marguerite felt her heartstrings tighten as she thought of this young couple so lately wedded. People smiled a little when Sir Andrew Ffoulkes' name was mentioned. Some called him effeminate, others uxorious. His fond attachment for his pretty little wife was thought to pass the bounds of decorum. There was no doubt that since his marriage the young man had greatly changed. His love of sport and adventure seemed to have died out completely, yielding evidently to the great, more overpowering love, that for his young wife. Suzanne was nervous for her husband's safety. She had sufficient influence over him to keep him at home when other members of the brave little league of the Scarlet Pimpernel followed their leader with mad zest on some bold adventure. Marguerite, too, at first had smiled in kindly derision when Suzanne Ffoulkes, her large eyes filled with tears, had used her wiles to keep Sir Andrew tied to her own dainty apron strings. But somehow lately, with that gentle contempt which she felt for the weaker man, there had mingled a half-acknowledged sense of envy. How different twixt her and her husband! Percy loved her truly and with a depth of passion proportionate to his own curious dual personality. It was sacrilege almost to doubt the intensity of his love, but nevertheless she had at all times a feeling as if he were holding himself and his emotions in check, as if his love, as if she, Marguerite, his wife, were but secondary matters in his life, as if her anxieties, her sorrow when he left her, her fears for his safety, were but small episodes in the great book of life which he had planned out and conceived for himself. Then she would hate herself for such thoughts. They seemed like doubts of him. Did any man ever love a woman, she asked herself, as Percy loved her? He was difficult to understand, and perhaps—oh, that was an awful perhaps. Perhaps there lurked somewhere in his mind a slight mistrust of her. She had betrayed him once, unwittingly, 'tis true. Did he fear she might do so again? And tonight, after her guests had gone, she threw open the great windows that gave on the beautiful terrace, with its marble steps leading down to the cool river beyond. Everything now seemed so peaceful and still. The scent of the heliotrope made the night air swoon with its intoxicating fragrance. The rhythmic murmur of the waters came gently echoing from below, and from far away there came the melancholy cry of a nightbird on the prowl. That cry made Marguerite shudder. Her thoughts flew back to the episodes of this night and to Chauvelin, the dark bird of prey with his mysterious death-dealing plans, his subtle intrigues which all tended towards the destruction of one man, his enemy, the husband whom Marguerite loved. Oh, how she hated these wild adventures which took Percy away from her side! Is not a woman who loves, be it husband or child, the most truly selfish, the most cruelly callous creature in the world, there where the safety and well-being of the loved one is in direct conflict with the safety and well-being of others? She would right gladly have closed her eyes to every horror perpetrated in France. She would not have known what went on in Paris. She wanted her husband. And yet, month after month, with but short intervals, she saw him risk that precious life of his, which was the very essence of her own soul, for others. For others! Always for others! And she, Marguerite, his wife, was powerless to hold him back, powerless to keep him beside her, when that mad fit of passion seized him to go on one of these wild quests wherefrom she always feared he could not return alive. And this, although she might use every noble artifice, every tender wile of which a loving and beautiful wife is capable. At times like those, her own proud heart was filled with hatred and envy towards everything that took him away from her. And tonight, all these passionate feelings which she felt were quite unworthy of her and of him, seemed to surge within her soul more tumultuously than ever. She was longing to throw herself in his arms, to pour out into his loving ear all that she suffered, in fear and anxiety, and to make one more appeal to his tenderness and to that passion which she had so often made him forget the world at her feet. And so instinctively she walked along the terrace toward that more secluded part of the garden, just above the river bank, where she had so oft wandered hand in hand with him, in the honeymoon of their love. There great clumps of old-fashioned cabbage roses grew in untidy splendour, and belated lilies sent intoxicating odours into the air, whilst the heavy masses of Egyptian and Michaelmas daisies looked like ghostly constellations in the gloom. She thought Percy must soon be coming this way. Though it was so late, she knew that he would not go to bed. After the events of the night, his ruling passion, strong in death, would hold him in its thrall. She too felt wide awake, and unconscious of fatigue. When she reached the secluded path beside the river, she peered eagerly up and down and listened for a sound. Presently it seemed to her that above the gentle clapper of the waters she could hear a rustle and the scrunching of the fine gravel under carefully measured footsteps. She waited a while. The footsteps seemed to draw nearer, and soon, although the starlit night was very dark, she perceived a cloaked and hooded figure approaching cautiously toward her. "Who goes there?" she called suddenly. The figure paused, then came rapidly forward, and a voice said timidly, "Ah, Lady Blakeney!" "Who are you?" asked Marguerite peremptorily.
"It is I, Désiré Candeille," replied the midnight prowler.
"Demoiselle Candeille!" ejaculated Marguerite, wholly taken by surprise. "What are you doing here? Alone, and at this hour?" "Shh!" whispered Candeille eagerly as she approached quite close to Marguerite and drew her hood still lower over her eyes.
"I am all alone. I wanted to see someone, you if possible, Lady Blakeney, for I could not rest. I wanted to know what had happened. What had happened? When? I don't understand. What happened between Citizen Chauvelin and your husband? Asked Candeille.
What is that to you? Replied Marguerite haughtily.
I pray you do not misunderstand me, pleaded Candeille eagerly. I know my presence in your house, the quarrel which I provoked, must have filled your heart with hatred and suspicion towards me. But, oh, how can I persuade you? I acted unwillingly. Will you not believe me? I was that man's tool, and, oh God, she added with sudden wild vehemence, if only you could know what tyranny that accursed government of France exercises over poor helpless women or men who happen to have fallen within the reach of its relentless clutches. Her voice broke down in a sob. Marguerite hardly knew what to say or think. She had always mistrusted this woman with her theatrical ways and stagey airs from the very first moment she saw her in the tent on the green, and she did not wish to run counter against her instinct in anything pertaining to the present crisis. And yet, in spite of her mistrust, the actress's vehement words found an echo in the depths of her own heart. How well she knew that tyranny of which Candeille spoke with such bitterness! Had she not suffered from it, endured terrible sorrow and humiliation, when, under the ban of that same appalling tyranny, she had betrayed the identity, then unknown to her, of the Scarlet Pimpernel? Therefore, when Candeille paused after those last excited words, she said with more gentleness than she had shown hitherto, though still quite coldly, "But you have not yet told me why you came back here tonight. If Citizen Chauvelin was your taskmaster, then you must know all that has occurred."
"I had a vague hope that I might see you."
"For what purpose?"
"To warn you if I could."
"I need no warning."
"Or are too proud to take one. Do you know, Lady Blakeney, that Citizen Chauvelin has a personal hatred against your husband?"
"How do you know that?" asked Marguerite, with her suspicions once more on the qui vive. She could not understand Candeille's attitude. This midnight visit, the vehemence of her language, the strange mixture of knowledge and ignorance which she displayed. What did this woman know of Chauvelin's secret plans? Was she his open ally or his helpless tool? And was she even now playing a part taught her or commanded her by that prince of intriguers? Candeille, however, seemed quite unaware of the spirit of antagonism and mistrust which Marguerite took but little pains now to disguise. She clasped her hands together, and her voice shook with the earnestness of her entreaty.
"Oh," she said eagerly, "have I not seen that look of hatred in Chauvelin's cruel eyes? He hates your husband, I tell you. Why, I know not, but he hates him, and means that great harm shall come to Sir Percy through this absurd duel. Oh, Lady Blakeney, do not let him go, I entreat you, do not let him go."
But Marguerite proudly drew back a step or two, away from the reach of those hands stretched out towards her in such vehement appeal. "You are overwrought, mademoiselle," she said coldly. "Believe me, I have no need either of your entreaties or of your warning. I should like you to think that I have no wish to be ungrateful, but I appreciate any kind thought you may have harboured for me in your mind. But beyond that, please forgive me if I say it somewhat crudely. I do not feel that the matter concerns you in the least. The hour is late," she added more gently, as if desiring to attenuate the harshness of her last words. "Shall I send my maid to escort you home? She is devoted and discreet."
"Nay," retorted the other in tones of quiet sadness, "there is no need of discretion. I am not ashamed of my visit to you tonight. You are very proud, and for your sake I will pray to God that sorrow and humiliation may not come to you as I feared. We are never likely to meet again, Lady Blakeney. You will not wish it, and I shall have passed out of your life as swiftly as I had entered into it. But there was another thought lurking in my mind when I came tonight. In case Sir Percy goes to France, the duel is to take place in or near Boulogne. This much I do know. Would you not wish to go with him?"
"Truly, mademoiselle, I must repeat to you that 'tis no concern of mine. I know, I own that. But you see, when I came back here tonight, in the silence and the darkness, I had not guessed that you would be so proud. I had thought that I, a woman, would know how to touch your womanly heart. I was clumsy, I suppose. I made so sure that you would wish to go with your husband in case he insisted on running his head into the noose, which I feel sure Chauvelin has prepared for him. I myself start for France shortly. Citizen Chauvelin has provided me with the necessary passport for myself and my maid, who was to have accompanied me. Then, just as now, when I was all alone, and thought over all the mischief which that fiend had forced me to do for him, it seemed to me that perhaps—" She broke off abruptly, and tried to read the other woman's face in the gloom. but Marguerite, who was taller than the Frenchwoman, was standing very stiff and erect, giving the young actress neither discouragement nor confidence. She did not interrupt Candeille's long and voluble explanation. Vaguely she wondered what it was all about, and even now, when the Frenchwoman paused, Marguerite said nothing, but watched her quietly as she took a folded paper from the capacious pocket of her cloak, and then held it out with a look of timidity towards Lady Blakeney.
"My maid need not come with me," said Desiree Candeille humbly. "I would far rather travel alone. This is her passport, and... Oh, you need not take it out of my hand," she added in tones of bitter self-deprecation, as Marguerite made no sign of taking the paper from her. "See, I will leave it here among the roses. You mistrust me now. It is only natural. Presently, perhaps, calmer reflection will come. You will see that my purpose now is selfless, that I only wish to serve you and him."
She stooped and placed the folded paper in the midst of a great clump of centifolium roses, and then, without another word, she turned and went her way. For a few moments, whilst Marguerite still stood there, puzzled and vaguely moved, she could hear the gentle frou-frou of the other woman's skirts against the soft sand of the path, and then a long-drawn sigh that sounded like a sob. Then all was still again. The gentle midnight breeze caressed the tops of the ancient oaks and elms behind her, drawing murmurs from their dying leaves like unto the whisperings of ghosts. Marguerite shuddered with a slight sense of cold. Before her, amongst the dark clump of leaves and the roses, invisible in the gloom, there fluttered with a curious, melancholy flapping the folded paper placed there by Candeille. She watched it for a while, as disturbed by the wind it seemed ready to take its flight towards the river. Anon it fell to the ground, and Marguerite, with sudden overpowering impulse, stooped and picked it up. Then, clutching it nervously in her hand, she walked rapidly back towards the house. End of chapter 14. Chapter 15 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 15. Farewell. As she neared the terrace, she became conscious of several forms moving about at the foot of the steps, some few feet below where she was standing. Soon she saw the glimmer of lanterns, heard whispering voices and the lapping of the water against the side of a boat. Anon a figure, laden with cloaks and sundry packages, passed down the steps close beside her. Even in the darkness Marguerite recognized Benyon, her husband's confidential valet. Without a moment's hesitation she flew along the terrace towards the wing of the house occupied by Sir Percy. She had not gone far before she discerned his tall figure, walking leisurely along the path which here skirted part of the house. He had on his large caped coat, which was thrown open in front, displaying a grey travelling suit of fine cloth. His hands were as usual buried in the pockets of his breeches, and on his head he wore the folding chapeau bras which he habitually affected. Before she had time to think or to realise that he was going, before she could utter one single word, she was in his arms, clinging to him with passionate intensity, trying in the gloom to catch every expression of his eyes, every quiver of the face now bent down so close to her. "Percy, you cannot go. You cannot go," she pleaded. She had felt his strong arms closing round her, his lips seeking hers, her eyes, her hair, her clinging hands, which dragged at his shoulders in a wild agony of despair. "If you really loved me, Percy," she murmured, "you would not go. You would not go." He would not trust himself to speak. It well nigh seemed as if his sinews cracked with the violent effort at self-control. Oh, how she loved him when she felt in him the passionate lover, the wild, untamed creature that he was at heart, on whom the frigid courtliness of manner sat but as a thin veneer. This was his own real personality. There was little now of the elegant and accomplished gentleman of fashion, schooled to hold every emotion in check, to hide every thought, every desire save that for amusement or for display. She, feeling her power and his weakness now, gave herself wholly to his embrace, not grudging one single passionate caress, yielding her lips to him, the while she murmured, "You cannot go, you cannot, why should you go? It is madness to leave me, I cannot let you go." Her arms clung tenderly round him, her voice was warm and faintly shaken with suppressed tears, and as he wildly murmured, "Don't, for pity's sake," she almost felt that her love would be triumphant. "For pity's sake I'll go on pleading, Percy," she whispered. "Oh, my love, my dear, do not leave me. We have scarce had time to savour our happiness. We have such arrears of joy to make up. Do not go, Percy. There's so much I want to say to you. Nay, you shall not. You shall not," she added with sudden vehemence. "Look me straight in the eyes, my dear, and tell me if you can leave now."
He did not reply, but almost roughly he placed his hand over her tear-dimmed eyes, which were turned up to his, in an agony of tender appeal. Thus he blindfolded her with that wild caress. She should not see, no, not even she, that for the space of a few seconds stern manhood was well-nigh vanquished by the magic of her love. All that was most human in him, all that was weak in this strong and untamed nature, cried aloud for peace and luxury and idleness, for long summer afternoons spent in lazy content, for the companionship of horses and dogs and of flowers, with no thought or cares save those for the next evening's gavotte, no graver occupation save that of sitting at her feet. And during these few seconds, whilst his hand lay across her eyes, the lazy, idle fop of fashionable London was fighting a hand-to-hand fight with the bold leader of a band of adventurers, and his own passionate love for his wife ranged itself with fervent intensity on the side of his weaker self. Forgotten were the horrors of the guillotine, the calls of the innocent, the appeal of the helpless, forgotten the daring adventures, the excitements, the hair's-breadth escapes. For those few seconds, heavenly in themselves, he only remembered her, his wife, her beauty and her tender appeal to him. She would have pleaded again, for she felt that she was winning in this fight. Her instinct, that unerring instinct of the woman who loves and feels herself beloved, told her that for the space of an infinitesimal fraction of time his iron will was inclined to bend, but he checked her pleading with a kiss. Then there came a change. Like a gigantic wave carried inwards by the tide, his turbulent emotion seemed suddenly to shatter itself against a rock of self-control. Was it a call from the boatman below? A distant scrunching of feet upon the gravel? Who knows? Perhaps only a sigh in the midnight air, a ghostly summons from the land of dreams that recalled him to himself. Even as Marguerite was still clinging to him with an ardent fervour of her own passion, she felt the rigid tension of his arms relax, the power of his embrace weaken, the wild love-light become dim in his eyes. He kissed her fondly, tenderly, and with infinite gentleness smoothed away the little damp curls from her brow. There was a wistfulness now in his caress, and in his kiss there was the finality of a long farewell. "'Tis time I went," he said, "or we shall miss the tide." These were the first coherent words he had spoken since first she had met him here in this lonely part of the garden, and his voice was perfectly steady, conventional, and cold. An icy pang shot through Marguerite's heart. It was as if she had been abruptly wakened from a beautiful dream. "You're not going, Percy," she murmured, and her own voice now sounded hollow and forced. "Oh, if you loved me, you would not go." "If I love you?" Nay, in this at least there was no dream, no coldness in his voice when he repeated those words with such a sigh of tenderness, such a world of longing, that the bitterness of her great pain vanished, giving place to tears. He took her hand in his. The passion was momentarily conquered, forced within his innermost soul by his alter ego, that second personality in him, the cold-blooded and coolly calculating adventurer who juggled with his life and tossed it recklessly upon the sea of chance, twixt a doggerel and a smile. But the tender love lingered on, fighting the enemy a while longer, the wistful desire was there for her kiss, the tired longing for the exquisite repose of her embrace. He took her hand in his, and bent his lips to it, and with the warmth of his kiss upon it she felt a moisture like a tear. "I must go, dear," he said after a little while. "Why, why?" she repeated obstinately. "Am I nothing, then? Is my life of no account? My sorrows, my fears, my misery? Oh," she added with vehement bitterness, "why should it always be others? What are others to you and me, Percy? Are we not happy here? Have you not fulfilled to its uttermost that self-imposed duty to people who can be nothing to us? Is not your life 10,000 times more precious to me than the lives of 10,000 others?" Even through the darkness, and because his face was so close to hers, she could see a quaint little smile playing round the corners of his mouth. "Nay, my dear," he said gently, "'tis not 10,000 lives that call to me to-day. Only one at best. Don't you hate to think of that poor little old curé, sitting in the midst of his ruined pride and hopes? The jewels so confidently entrusted to his care stolen from him, he waiting, perhaps, in his little presbytery, for the day when those brutes will march him to prison and to death. Nay, I think a little sea-voyage and English country air would suit the Abbé Fouquet, my dear, and I only mean to ask him to cross the Channel with me." "Percy," she pleaded. "Oh, I know," he rejoined, with that short deprecatory sigh of his, which seemed always to close any discussion between them on that point. "You are thinking of that absurd duel." He laughed lightly, good-humouredly, and his eyes gleamed with merriment.
"La, my dear," he said gaily, "will you not reflect a moment? Could I refuse the challenge before His Royal Highness and the ladies? I couldn't. Faith, that was it. Just a case of couldn't. Fate did it all. The quarrel, my interference, the challenge. He had planned it all, of course. Let us own that he is a brave man, seeing that he and I are not even yet for that beating he gave me on the Calais cliffs." "Yes, he has planned it all," she retorted vehemently. "The quarrel tonight, your journey to France, your meeting with him face to face at a given hour and place where he can most readily, most easily close the death-trap upon you." This time he broke into a laugh, a good, hearty laugh, full of the joy of living, of the madness and intoxication of a bold adventure, a laugh that had not one particle of anxiety or of tremor in it. "Nay, my dear," he said, "but your ladyship is astonishing. Close a death-trap upon your humble servant? Nay, the governing citizens of France will have to be very active and mighty wide awake ere they succeed in stealing a march on me. Zounds, but we'll give them an exciting chase this time. Nay, little woman, do not fear," he said with sudden, infinite gentleness. "Those demmed murderers have not got me yet." Oh, how often she had fought with him thus, with him, the adventurer, the part of his dual nature that was her bitter enemy, and which took him, the lover, away from her side. She knew so well the finality of it all, the amazing hold which that unconquerable desire for these mad adventures had upon him. Impulsive, ardent as she was, Marguerite felt in her very soul an overwhelming fury against herself, her own weakness, her own powerlessness in the face of that which forever threatened to ruin her life and her happiness. Yes, and his also, for he loved her, he loved her, he loved her. The thought went on hammering in her mind, for she knew of its great truth. He loved her and went away, and she, poor puny weakling, was unable to hold him back. The tendrils which fastened his soul to hers were not so tenacious as those which made him cling to suffering humanity over there in France, where men and women were in fear of death and torture, and looked upon the elusive and mysterious Scarlet Pimpernel as a heaven-born hero sent to save them from their doom. To them, at these times, his very heartstrings seemed to turn with unconquerable force, and when, with all the ardour of her own passion, she tried to play upon the cause of his love for her, he could not respond, for they, the strangers, had the stronger claim. And yet through it all, she knew that this love of humanity, this mad desire to serve and to help, in no way detracted from his love for her. Nay, it intensified it, made it purer and better, adding to the joy of perfect intercourse the poetic and subtle fragrance of ever-recurring pain. But now at last she felt weary of the fight. Her heart was aching, bruised and sore. An infinite fatigue seemed to weigh like lead upon her very soul. This seemed so different to any other parting that had perforce been during the past year. The presence of Chauvelin in her house, the obvious planning in this departure for France, had filled her with a foreboding, nay, almost a certitude, of a gigantic and deadly cataclysm. Her senses began to reel. She seemed not to see anything very distinctly. Even the loved form took on a strange and ghost-like shape. He now looked preternaturally tall, and there was a mist between her and him. She thought that he spoke to her again, but she was not quite sure, for his voice sounded like some weird and mysterious echo. A bosquet of climbing heliotrope close by threw a fragrance into the evening air, which turned her giddy with its overpowering sweetness. She closed her eyes, for she felt as if she must die if she held them open any longer. And as she closed them, it seemed to her as if he folded her in one last, long, heavenly embrace. He felt her graceful figure swaying in his arms like a tall and slender lily bending to the wind. He saw that she was but half conscious, and thanked heaven for this kindly solace to his heart-breaking farewell. There was a sloping, mossy bank close by. There, where the marble terrace yielded to the encroaching shrubbery, a tangle of pale pink monthly roses made a bower overhead. She was just sufficiently conscious to enable him to lead her to this soft green couch. There he laid her amongst the roses, kissed the dear tired eyes, her hands, her lips, her tiny feet, and went. End of chapter 15. Chapter 16 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 16. The Passport. The rhythmic clapper of oars roused Marguerite from this trance-like swoon. In a moment she was on her feet, all her fatigue gone, her numbness of soul and body vanished as in a flash.
She was fully conscious now, conscious that he had gone, that according to every probability under heaven and every machination concocted in hell, he would never return from France alive, and that she had failed to hear the last words which he spoke to her, had failed to glean his last look, or to savour his final kiss. Though the night was starlit and balmy, it was singularly dark, and vainly did Marguerite strain her eyes to catch sight of that boat which was bearing him away so swiftly now. She strained her ears, vaguely hoping to catch one last lingering echo of his voice, but all was silence, save that monotonous clapper, which seemed to beat against her like a rhythmic knell of death. She could hear the oars distinctly. There were six or eight, she thought, certainly no fewer. Eight oarsmen probably, which meant the larger boat, and undoubtedly the longer journey, not to London only with a view to posting to Dover, but to Tilbury Fort, where the Daydream would be in readiness to start with a favourable tide. Thought was returning to her slowly and coherently. The pain of the last farewell was still there, bruising her very senses with its dull and heavy weight, but it had become numb and dead, leaving her, herself, her heart and soul, stunned and apathetic, whilst her brain was gradually resuming its activity. And the more she thought it over, the more certain she grew that her husband was going as far as Tilbury by river, and would embark on the Daydream there. Of course he would go to Boulogne at once. The duel was to take place there, Candeille had told her, adding that she thought she, Marguerite, would wish to go with him. To go with him! Heavens above! Was not that the only real, tangible thought in that whirling chaos which was raging in her mind? To go with him! Surely there must be some means of reaching him yet. Fate, nature, God himself would never permit so monstrous a thing as this, that she should be parted from her husband now when his life was not only in danger, but forfeited already, lost, a precious thing all but gone from this world. Percy was going to Boulogne. She must go too. By posting at once to Dover she could get the tidal boat on the morrow and reach the French coast quite as soon as the Daydream. Once at Boulogne she would have no difficulty in finding her husband, of that she felt sure. She would have but to dog Chauvelin's footsteps, find out something of his plans, of the orders he gave to troops or to spies. Oh, she would find him. Of that she was never for a moment in doubt. How well she remembered her journey to Calais just a year ago, in company with Sir Andrew Ffoulkes. Chance had favoured her then, had enabled her to be of service to her husband, if only by distracting Chauvelin's attention for a while to herself. Heaven knows she had but little hope of being of use to him now. An aching sense was in her that fate had at last been too strong, that the daring adventurer had staked once too often, had cast the die and had lost. In the bosom of her dress she felt the sharp edge of the paper left for her by Desiree Candeille among the roses in the park. She had picked it up almost mechanically then and tucked it away, hardly heeding what she was doing. Whatever the motive of the French actress had been in placing the passport at her disposal, Marguerite blessed her in her heart for it. To the woman she had mistrusted, she would owe the last supreme happiness of her life. Her resolution never once wavered. Percy could not take her with him, that was understandable. She could neither expect it nor think it. But she, on the other hand, could not stay in England, at Blakeney Manor, whilst any day, any hour, the death-trap set by Chauvelin for the Scarlet Pimpernel might be closing upon the man whom she worshipped. She would go mad if she stayed. As there could be no chance of escape for Percy now, as he had agreed to meet his deadly enemy face to face at a given place and a given hour, she could not be a hindrance to him. And she knew enough subterfuge, enough machinations and disguises by now, to escape Chauvelin's observation, unless Percy wanted her, and then she would be there. No, she could not be a hindrance. She had a passport in her pocket, everything en règle, nobody could harm her, she could come and go as she pleased. There were plenty of swift horses in the stables, plenty of devoted servants to do her bidding quickly and discreetly. Moreover, at moments like these, conventionalities and the possible conjectures and surmises of others became of infinitesimally small importance. The household of Blakeney Manor were accustomed to the master's sudden journeys and absences of several days, presumably on some shooting or other sporting expeditions, with no one in attendance on him save Benyon, his favourite valet. These passed without any comments now. Bah! Let everyone marvel for once at her ladyship's sudden desire to go to Dover, and let it all be a 9 days' wonder. She certainly did not care. Skirting the house, she reached the stables beyond. One or two men were astir. To these she gave the necessary orders for her coach and four. Then she found her way back to the house. Walking along the corridor, she went past the room occupied by Juliette de Marny. For a moment she hesitated, then she turned and knocked at the door.
Juliette was not yet in bed, for she went to the door herself and opened it. Obviously she had been quite unable to rest. Her hair was falling loosely over her shoulders, and there was a look of grave anxiety in her young face.
"Juliette," said Marguerite in a hurried whisper, the moment she had closed the door behind her and she and the young girl were alone, "I am going to France to be near my husband. He has gone to meet that fiend in a duel which is nothing but a trap, set to capture him and lead him to his death. I want you to be of help to me, here in my house, in my absence."
"I would give my life for you, Lady Blakeney," said Juliette simply. "Is it not his, since he saved it?"
"It is only a little presence of mind, a little coolness and patience, which I will ask of you, dear," said Marguerite. "You, of course, know who your rescuer was. Therefore you will understand my fears. Until tonight I had vague doubts as to how much Chauvelin really knew, but now these doubts have naturally vanished. He and the French Revolutionary Government know that the Scarlet Pimpernel and Percy Blakeney are one and the same. The whole scene tonight was prearranged. You and I and all the spectators, and that woman Candeille, we were all puppets piping to that devil's tune. The duel, too, was prearranged. That woman wearing your mother's jewels. Had you not provoked her, a quarrel between her and me, or one of my guests, would have been forced somehow. I wanted to tell you this, lest you should fret and think that you were in any way responsible for what has happened. You were not. He had arranged it all. You were only the tool, just as I was. You must understand and believe that. Percy would hate to think that you felt yourself to blame. You are not that, in any way. The challenge was bound to come. Chauvelin had arranged that it should come. And if you had failed him as a tool, he would soon have found another. Do you believe that?"
"I believe that you are an angel of goodness, Lady Blakeney," replied Juliette, struggling with her tears, "and that you are the only woman in the world worthy to be his wife."
"But," insisted Marguerite firmly, as the young girl took her cold hand in her own and, gently fondling it, covered it with grateful kisses, "but if anything happens, anon, you will believe firmly that you were in no way responsible, that you were innocent and merely a blind tool?
God bless you for that. You will believe it."
"I will."
"And now for my request," rejoined Lady Blakeney, in a more quiet, more matter-of-fact tone of voice. "You must represent me here when I am gone. Explain as casually and as naturally as you can that I have gone to join my husband on his yacht for a few days. Lucy, my maid, is devoted and a tower of secrecy. She will stand between you and the rest of the household in concocting some plausible story. To every friend who calls, to any one of our world whom you may meet, you must tell the same tale. And if you note an air of incredulity in any one, if you hear whispers of there being some mystery, well, let the world wag its busy tongue. I care less than naught. It will soon tire of me and my doings, and having torn my reputation to shreds will quickly leave me in peace. But to Sir Andrew Ffoulkes," she added earnestly, "tell the whole truth from me. He will understand and do as he thinks right."
"I will do all you ask, Lady Blakeney, and am proud to think that I shall be serving you, even in so humble and easy a capacity. When do you start?"
"At once. Goodbye, Juliet."
She bent down to the young girl and kissed her tenderly on the forehead. Then she glided out of the room as rapidly as she had come. Juliet, of course, did not try to detain her, or to force her help of companionship on her when obviously she would wish to be alone. Marguerite quickly reached her room. Her maid, Lucy, was already waiting for her. Devoted and silent as she was, one glance at her mistress's face told her that trouble, grave and imminent, had reached Blakeney Manor. Marguerite, whilst Lucy undressed her, took up the passport and carefully perused the personal description of one Céline Dumont, maid to citizeness Désirée Candeille, which was given therein: tall, blue eyes, light hair, age about 25. It all might have been vaguely meant for her. She had a dark cloth gown and long black cloak with hood to come well over the head. These she now donned, with some thick shoes and a dark-coloured handkerchief tied over her head under the hood, so as to hide the golden glory of her hair. She was quite calm and in no haste. She made Lucy pack a small hand-valise with some necessaries for the journey, and provided herself plentifully with money, English and French notes, which she tucked well away inside her dress. Then she bade her maid, who was struggling with her tears, a kindly farewell, and quickly went down to her coach. End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in February 2008. Chapter 17. Boulogne. During the journey Marguerite had not much leisure to think.
The discomforts and petty miseries incidental on cheap travelling had the very welcome effect of making her forget, for the time being, the soul-rendering crisis through which she was now passing. For, of necessity, she had to travel at the cheap rate, among the crowd of poorer passengers who were herded aft the packet-boat, leaning up against one another, sitting on bundles and packages of all kinds. That part of the deck, reeking with the smell of tar and sea-water, damp, squally, and stuffy, was an abomination of hideous discomfort to the dainty, fastidious lady of fashion, yet she almost welcomed the intolerable propinquity, the cold douches of salt-water which every now and then wetted her through and through, for it was the consequent sense of physical wretchedness that helped her to forget the intolerable anguish of her mind. And among these poorer travellers she felt secure from observation. No one took much notice of her. She looked just like one of the herd, and in the huddled-up little figure, in the dark, bedraggled clothes, no one would for a moment have recognised the dazzling personality of Lady Blakeney. Drawing her hood well over her head, she sat in a secluded corner of the deck, upon the little black valise which contained the few belongings she had brought with her. Her cloak and dress, now mud-stained and dank with splashings of salt water, attracted no one's attention. There was a keen northeasterly breeze, cold and penetrating, but favourable to a rapid crossing. Marguerite, who had gone through several hours of weary travelling by coach before she had embarked at Dover in the late afternoon, was unspeakably tired. She had watched the golden sunset out at sea until her eyes were burning with pain, and as the dazzling crimson and orange and purple gave place to the soft grey tones of evening, she descried the round cupola of the Church of Our Lady of Boulogne against the dull background of the sky. After that her mind became a blank. A sort of torpor fell over her sense. She was wakeful and yet half asleep, unconscious of everything around her, seeing nothing but the distant massive towers of old Boulogne churches gradually detaching themselves one by one from out the fast-gathering gloom. The town seemed like a dream city, a creation of some morbid imagination presented to her mind's eye as the city of sorrow and death. When the boat finally scraped her sides along the rough wooden jetty, Marguerite felt as if she were forcibly awakened. She was numb and stiff, and thought she must have fallen asleep during the last half-hour of the journey. Everything around her was dark. The sky was overcast, and the night seemed unusually sombre. Figures were moving all around her. There was noise and confusion of voices, and a general pushing and shouting which seemed strangely weird in this gloom. Here among the poorer passengers there had not been thought any necessity for a light. One solitary lantern fixed to a mast only enhanced the intense blackness of everything around. Now and then a face would come within range of this meagre streak of yellow light, looking strangely distorted, with great, elongated shadows across the brow and chin, a grotesque, ghostly apparition which quickly vanished again, scurrying off like some frightened gnome, giving place other forms, other figures, all equally grotesque and equally weird. Marguerite watched them all half stupidly and motionlessly for a while. She did not quite know what she ought to do, and did not like to ask any questions. She was dazed, and the darkness blinded her. Then gradually things began to detach themselves more clearly. On looking straight before her, she began to discern the landing-place, the little wooden bridge across which the passengers walked one by one from the boat unto the jetty. The first-class passengers were evidently all alighting now. The crowd of which Marguerite formed a unit had been pushed back in a more compact herd, out of the way for the moment, so that their betters might get along more comfortably. Beyond the landing-stage a little booth had been erected, a kind of tent, open in front and lighted up within by a couple of lanterns. Under this tent there was a table, behind which sat a man dressed in some sort of official-looking clothes, and wearing the tricolour scarf across his chest. All the passengers from the boat had apparently defiled past this tent. Marguerite could see them now quite distinctly, the profiles of the various faces as they paused for a moment in front of the table being brilliantly illuminated by one of the lanterns. Two sentinels wearing the uniform of the National Guard stood each side of the table. The passengers, one by one, took out their passport as they went by, handed it to the man in the official dress, who examined it carefully, very lengthily, then signed it and returned the paper to its owner. But at times he appeared doubtful, folded the passport, and put it down in front of him. The passenger would protest. Marguerite could not hear what was said, but she could see that some argument was attempted, quickly dismissed by a peremptory order from the official.
The doubtful passport was obviously put on one side for further examination, and the unfortunate owner thereof detained, until he or she had been able to give more satisfactory references to the representatives of the Committee of Public Safety stationed at Boulogne. This process of examination necessarily took a long time. Marguerite was getting horribly tired, her feet ached, and she scarcely could hold herself upright. Yet she watched all these people mechanically, making absurd little guesses in her weary mind as to whose passport would find favour in the eyes of the official, and whose would be found suspect and inadequate. Suspect! A terrible word these times, since Merlin's terrible law decreed now that every man, woman, or child who was suspected by the Republic of being a traitor was a traitor in fact. How sorry she felt for those whose passports were detained, who tried to argue so needlessly, and who were finally led off by a soldier who had stepped out from somewhere in the dark and had to await further examination, probably imprisonment and often death. As to herself, she felt quite safe. The passport given to her by Chauvelin's own accomplice was sure to be quite en règle. Then suddenly her heart seemed to give a sudden leap, and then to stop in its beating for a second or two. In one of the passengers, a man who was just passing in front of the tent, she had recognized the form and profile of Chauvelin. He had no passport to show, but evidently the official knew who he was, for he stood up and saluted, and listened deferentially whilst the ex-ambassador apparently gave him a few instructions. It seemed to Marguerite that these instructions related to two women who were close behind Chauvelin at the time, and who presently seemed to file past without going through the usual formalities of showing their passports. But of this she could not be quite sure. The women were closely hooded and veiled, and her own attention had been completely absorbed by this sudden appearance of her deadly enemy. Yet what more natural than that Chauvelin should be here now? His object accomplished, he had no doubt posted to Dover just as she had done. There was no difficulty in that, and a man of his type and importance would always have unlimited means and money at his command to accomplish any journey he might desire to undertake. There was nothing strange or even unexpected in the man's presence here, and yet somehow it had made the whole awful reality more tangible, more wholly unforgettable. Marguerite remembered his abject words to her when first she had seen him at the Richmond fete. He said that he had fallen into disgrace, that having failed in his service to the Republic, he had been relegated to a subordinate position, pushed aside with contumely to make room for better, abler men. Well, all that was a lie, of course, a cunning method of gaining access into her house, of that she had already been convinced, when Candeille provoked the esclandre which led to the challenge. That on French soil he seemed in anything but a subsidiary position, that he appeared to rule rather than to obey, could in no way appear to Marguerite in the nature of surprise. As the actress had been a willing tool in the cunning hands of Chauvelin, so were probably all these people around her. Where others cringed in the face of officialism, the ex-ambassador had stepped forth as a master. He had shown a badge, spoken a word mayhap, and the man in the tent, who had made other people tremble, stood up deferentially and obeyed all commands. It was all very simple and very obvious, but Marguerite's mind had been asleep, and it was the sight of the sable-clad little figure which had roused it from its happy torpor. In a moment now her brain was active and alert, and presently it seemed to her as if another figure, taller than those around, had crossed the barrier immediately in the wake of Chauvelin. Then she chided herself for her fancies. It could not be her husband, not yet. He had gone by water, and would scarcely be in Boulogne before the morning. Ah, now at last came the turn of the second-class passengers. There was a general bousculade, and the human bundle began to move. Marguerite lost sight of the tent and its awe-inspiring appurtenances. She was a mere unit again in this herd on the move. She, too, progressed along slowly, one step at a time. It was wearisome, and she was deadly tired. She was beginning to form plans now that she had arrived in France. All along she had made up her mind that she would begin by seeking out the Abbé Fouquet, for he would prove a link twixt her husband and herself. She knew that Percy would communicate with the Abbé. Had he not told her that the rescue of the devoted old man from the clutches of the terrorists would be one of the chief objects of his journey? It had never occurred to her what she would do if she found the Abbé Fouquet gone from Boulogne. "Hé, la mère, your passport!" The rough words roused her from her meditations. She had moved forward quite mechanically, her mind elsewhere, her thoughts not following the aim of her feet. Thus she must have crossed the bridge along with some of the crowd, must have landed on the jetty, and reached the front of the tent without really knowing what she was doing.
Ah, yes, her passport. She had quite forgotten that. But she had it by her, quite in order, given to her in a fit of tardy remorse by Demoiselle Candeille, the intimate friend of one of the most influential members of the revolutionary government of France. She took the passport from the bosom of her dress and handed it to the man in the official dress. "Your name?" he asked peremptorily.
"Céline Dumont," she replied unhesitatingly,
for had she not rehearsed all this in her mind dozens of times, until her tongue could rattle off the borrowed name as easily as it could her own? "Serviteur to citizeness Désirée Candeille." The man, who had very carefully been examining the paper the while, placed it down on the table deliberately in front of him and said, "Céline Dumont? Eh, la mère, what tricks are you up to now?"
"Tricks? I don't understand," she said quietly, for she was not afraid.
The passport was en règle. She knew she had nothing to fear. "Oh, but I think you do," retorted the official with a sneer, "and 'tis a mighty clever one, I'll allow.
Céline Dumont, ma foi!
Not badly imagined, ma petite mère. And all would have passed off splendidly. Unfortunately, Céline Dumont, servitor to citizeness Désirée Candeille, passed through these barriers along with her mistress not half an hour ago." And with a long, grimy finger he pointed to an entry in the large book which lay open before him, and wherein he had apparently been busy making notes of the various passengers who had filed past him. Then he looked up with a triumphant leer at the calm face of Marguerite. She still did not feel really frightened, only puzzled and perturbed, but all the blood had rushed away from her face, leaving her cheeks ashen white, and pressing against her heart, until it almost choked her.
"You are making a mistake, citizen," she said very quietly. "I am citizeness Candeille's maid. She gave me the passport herself, just before I left for England. If you will ask her the question, she will confirm what I say, and she assured me that it was quite en règle."
But the man only shrugged his shoulders and laughed derisively. The incident evidently amused him, yet he must have seen many of the same sort. In the far corner of the tent, Marguerite seemed to discern a few moving forms. Soldiers, she thought, for she caught sight of a glint like that of steel. One or two men stood close behind the official at the desk, and the sentinels were to the right and left of the tent. With an instinctive sense of appeal, Marguerite looked round from one face to the other, but each looked absolutely impassive and stolid, quite uninterested in this little scene, the exact counterpart of a dozen others, enacted on this very spot within the last hour.
"Eh là, la petite mère," said the official in the same tone of easy persiflage which he had adopted all along. "But we do know how to concoct a pretty lie, aye, and so circumstantially, too. Unfortunately, it was citizeness Désirée Candeille herself who happened to be standing just where you are at the present moment, along with her maid, Céline Dumont, both of whom were specially signed for and recommended as perfectly trustworthy by no less a person than citoyen Chauvelin of the Committee of Public Safety."
"But I assure you that there is a mistake," pleaded Marguerite earnestly. "'Tis the other woman who lied. I have my passport and—"
"A truce on this," retorted the man peremptorily. "If everything is as you say, and if you have nothing to hide, you'll be at liberty to continue your journey tomorrow, after you have explained yourself before the citizen governor. Next one now, quick!"
Marguerite tried another protest, just as those others had done, whom she had watched so mechanically before. But already she knew that that would be useless, for she had felt that a heavy hand was being placed on her shoulder, and that she was being roughly led away. In a flash she had understood and seen the whole sequel of the awful trap which had all along been destined to engulf her as well as her husband. What a clumsy, blind fool she had been! What a miserable antagonist to the subtle schemes of a past master of intrigue as was Chauvelin! To have enticed the Scarlet Pimpernel to France was a great thing. The challenge was clever, the acceptance of it by the bold adventurer a foregone conclusion. But the master stroke of the whole plan was done when she, the wife, was enticed over too, with the story of Candeille's remorse and the offer of the passport. Fool, fool that she was! And how well did Chauvelin know feminine nature! How cleverly he had divined her thoughts, her feelings, the impulsive way in which she would act! How easily he had guessed that, knowing her husband's danger, she, Marguerite, would immediately follow him. Now the trap had closed on her, and she saw it all when it was too late. Percy Blakeney in France, his wife a prisoner, her freedom and safety in exchange for his life. The hopelessness of it all struck her with appalling force, and her sense reeled with the awful finality of the disaster. Yet instinct in her still struggled for freedom.
Ahead of her, and all around, beyond the tent and in the far distance, there was a provocative, alluring darkness. If only she could get away, only could reach the shelter of that remote and sombre distance, she would hide and wait, not blunder again, no, no. She would be prudent and wary, if only she could get away. One woman's struggles against five men. It was pitiable, sublime, absolutely useless. The man in the tent seemed to be watching her with much amusement for a moment or two, as her whole graceful body stiffened for that absurd and unequal physical contest. He seemed vastly entertained at the sight of this good-looking young woman striving to pit her strength against five sturdy soldiers of the Republic. "Allons, that will do now," he said at last, roughly. "We have no time to waste. Get the jade away and let her cool her temper in Number 6 until the citizen governor gives further orders." "Take her away!" he shouted more loudly, banging a grimy fist down on the table before him, as Marguerite still struggled on with the blind madness of despair. "Pardi, can none of you rid us of that turbulent baggage?" The crowd behind were pushing forward. The guard within the tent were jeering at those who were striving to drag Marguerite away. These latter were cursing loudly and volubly, until one of them, tired out, furious and brutal, raised his heavy fist, and with an obscene oath brought it crashing down upon the unfortunate woman's head. Perhaps, though it was the work of a savage and cruel creature, the blow proved more merciful than it had been intended. It had caught Marguerite full between the eyes. Her aching senses, wearied and reeling already, gave way beneath this terrible violence. Her useless struggle ceased, her arms fell inert by her side, and losing consciousness completely, her proud, unbendable spirit was spared the humiliating knowledge of her final removal by the rough soldiers, and of the complete wreckage of her last lingering hopes. End of chapter 17. Chapter 18 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in February 2008. Chapter 18. Number 6. Consciousness returned very slowly, very painfully. It was night when last Marguerite had clearly known what was going on around her. It was daylight before she realized that she still lived, that she still knew and suffered. Her head ached intolerably. That was the first conscious sensation which came to her. Then she vaguely perceived a pale ray of sunshine, very hazy and narrow, which came from somewhere in front of her and struck her in the face. She kept her eyes tightly shut, for that filmy light caused her an increase of pain. She seemed to be lying on her back, and her fingers, wandering restlessly around, felt a hard palliasse beneath their touch, then a rough pillow, and her own cloak laid over her. Thought had not yet returned, only the sensation of great suffering and of infinite fatigue. Anon she ventured to open her eyes, and gradually one or two objects detached themselves from out the haze which still obscured her vision. Firstly, the narrow aperture, scarcely a window, filled in with tiny squares of coarse, unwashed glass, through which the rays of the morning sun were making kindly efforts to penetrate. Then the cloud of dust illumined by those same rays, and made up, so it seemed to the poor, tired brain that strove to perceive, of myriads of abnormally large molecules, overabundant and overactive, for they appeared to be dancing a kind of wild saraband before Marguerite's aching eyes, advancing and retreating, forming themselves into groups and taking on funny shapes of weird masks and grotesque faces, which grinned at the unconscious figure lying helpless on the rough palliasse. Through and beyond them, Marguerite gradually became aware of three walls of a narrow room, dank and grey, half covered with whitewash and half with greenish mildew. Yes, and there, opposite to her and immediately beneath that semblance of a window, was another palliasse, and on it something dark that moved. The words Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité ou la mort stared out at her from somewhere beyond those active molecules of dust, but she also saw, just above the other palliasse, the vague outline of a dark crucifix. It seemed a terrible effort to coordinate all these things, and to try and realize what the room was, and what was the meaning of the palliasse, the narrow window, and the stained walls, too much altogether for the aching head to take in, save very slowly, very gradually. Marguerite was content to wait, and to let memory creep back as reluctantly as it would.
"Do you think, my child, you could drink a little of this now?"
It was a gentle, rather tremulous voice which struck upon her ear. She opened her eyes, and noticed that the dark something which had previously been on the opposite palliasse was no longer there, and that there appeared to be a presence close to her only vaguely defined, someone kindly and tender who had spoken to her in French with that soft sing-song accent peculiar to the Normandy peasants, and who now seemed to be pressing something cool and soothing to her lips.
"They gave me this for you," continued the tremulous voice close to her ear. "I think it would do you good if you tried to take it."
A hand and arm was thrust underneath the rough pillow, causing her to raise her head a little. A glass was held to her lips, and she drank. The hand that held the glass was all wrinkled, brown and dry, and trembled slightly, but the arm which supported her head was firm and very kind.
"There, I am sure you feel better now. Close your eyes and try to go to sleep."
She did as she was bid, and was ready enough to close her eyes. It seemed to her presently as if something had been interposed between her aching head and that trying ray of white September sun. Perhaps she slept peacefully for a little while after that, for though her head was still very painful, her mouth and throat felt less parched and dry. Through this sleep, or semblance of sleep, she was conscious of the same pleasant voice, softly droning paters and aves close to her ear. Thus she lay during the greater part of the day, not quite fully conscious, not quite awake to the awful memories which anon would crowd upon her thick and fast. From time to time the same kind and trembling hands would, with gentle pressure, force a little liquid food through her unwilling lips, some warm soup, or anon a glass of milk. Beyond the pain in her head, she was conscious of no physical ill. She felt at perfect peace, and an extraordinary sense of quiet and repose seemed to pervade this small room, with its narrow window through which the rays of the sun came gradually in more golden splendour as the day drew towards noon, and then they vanished altogether. The drony voice close beside her acted as a soporific upon her nerves. In the afternoon she fell into a real and beneficent sleep. But after that she woke to full consciousness. Oh, the horror, the folly of it all! It came back to her with all the inexorable force of an appalling certainty. She was a prisoner in the hands of those who long ago had sworn to bring the Scarlet Pimpernel to death. She, his wife, a hostage in their hands, her freedom and safety offered to him as the price of his own. Here there was no question of dreams or of nightmares, no illusions as to the ultimate intentions of her husband's enemies. It was all a reality. And even now, before she had the strength fully to grasp the whole nature of this horrible situation, she knew that by her own act of mad and passionate impulse she had hopelessly jeopardized the life of the man she loved. For with that sublime confidence in him begotten of her love, she never for a moment doubted which of the two alternatives he would choose when once they were placed before him. He would sacrifice himself for her. He would prefer to die a thousand deaths, so long as they set her free. For herself, her own sufferings, her danger or humiliation, she cared nothing. Nay, at this very moment she was conscious of a wild, passionate desire for death. In this sudden onrush of memory and of thought, she wished with all her soul and heart and mind to die here suddenly on this hard palliasse, in this lonely and dark prison, so that she should be out of the way once and for all, so that she should not be the hostage to be bartered against his precious life and freedom. He would suffer acutely, terribly at her loss, because he loved her above everything else on earth. He would suffer in every fibre of his passionate and ardent nature, but he would not then have to endure the humiliations, the awful alternatives, the galling impotence and miserable death, the relentless either-or which his enemies were even now preparing for him. And then came a revulsion of feeling. Marguerite's was essentially a buoyant and active nature, a keen brain which worked and schemed and planned, rather than one ready to accept the inevitable. Hardly had these thoughts of despair and of death formulated themselves in her mind, than with brilliant swiftness a new train of ideas began to take root. What if matters were not so hopeless after all? Already her mind had flown instinctively to thoughts of escape. Had she the right to despair? She, the wife and intimate companion of the man who had astonished the world with his daring, his prowess, his amazing good luck, she to imagine for a moment that in this all-supreme moment of adventurous life the Scarlet Pimpernel would fail?
Was not English society peopled with men, women, and children, whom his ingenuity had rescued from plights quite as seemingly hopeless as her own? And would not all the resources of that inventive brain be brought to bear upon this rescue, which touched him nearer and more deeply than any which he had attempted hitherto? Now Marguerite was chiding herself for her doubts and for her fears. Already she remembered that amongst the crowd on the landing-stage she had perceived a figure, unusually tall, following in the wake of Chauvelin and his companions. Awakened hope had already assured her that she had not been mistaken, that Percy, contrary to her own surmises, had reached Boulogne last night. He always acted so differently to what anyone might expect, that it was quite possible that he had crossed over in the packet-boat, after all, unbeknown to Marguerite as well as to his enemies. Oh, yes! The more she thought about it all, the more sure she was that Percy was already in Boulogne, and that he knew of her capture and her danger. What right had she to doubt even for a moment that he would know how to reach her, how, when the time came, to save himself and her? A warm glow began to fill her veins. She felt excited and alert, absolutely unconscious now of pain or fatigue in this radiant joy of reawakened hope. She raised herself slightly, leaning on her elbow. She was still very weak, and the slight movement had made her giddy, but soon she would be strong and well. She must be strong and well, and ready to do his bidding when the time for escape would have come. "Ah, you are better, my child, I see," said that quaint, tremulous voice again, with its soft, sing-song accent. "But you must not be so venturesome, you know. The physician said that you had received a cruel blow. The brain has been rudely shaken, and you must lie quite still all to-day, or your poor little head will begin to ache again." Marguerite turned to look at the speaker, and in spite of her excitement, of her sorrow and of her anxieties, she could not help smiling at the whimsical little figure which sat opposite to her, on a very rickety chair, solemnly striving with slow and measured movement of hand and arm and a large supply of breath, to get up a polish on the worn-out surface of an ancient pair of buckled shoes. The figure was slender and almost wizened. The thin shoulders round with an habitual stoop, the lean shanks were encased in a pair of much-darned, coarse black stockings. It was the figure of an old man, with a gentle, clear-cut face, furrowed by a forest of wrinkles, and surmounted by scanty white locks above a smooth forehead, which looked yellow and polished like an ancient piece of ivory. He had looked across at Marguerite as he spoke, and a pair of innately kind and mild blue eyes were fixed with tender reproach upon her. Marguerite thought that she had never seen quite so much goodness and simple-heartedness portrayed on any face before. It literally beamed out of those pale blue eyes, which seemed quite full of unshed tears. The old man wore a tattered garment, a miracle of shining cleanliness, which had once been a soutane of smooth black cloth, but was now a mass of patches and threadbare at shoulders and knees. He seemed deeply intent in the task of polishing his shoes, and having delivered himself of his little admonition, he very solemnly and earnestly resumed his work. Marguerite's first and most natural instinct had, of course, been one of dislike and mistrust of anyone who appeared to be in some way on guard over her. But when she took in every detail of the quaint figure of the old man, his scrupulous tidiness of apparel, the resigned stoop of his shoulders, and met in full the gaze of those moist eyes, she felt that the whole aspect of the man, as he sat there polishing his shoes, was infinitely pathetic, and in its simplicity commanding of respect. "Who are you?" asked Lady Blakeney at last, for the old man, after looking at her with a kind of appealing wonder, seemed to be waiting for her to speak. "A priest of the good God, my dear child," replied the old man, with a deep sigh and a shake of his scanty locks, "who is not allowed to serve his divine master any longer. A poor old fellow, very harmless and very helpless, who had been set here to watch over you. You must not look upon me as a jailer because of what I say, my child," he added with a quaint air of deference and apology. "I am very old and very small, and only take up a very little room. I can make myself very scarce. You shall hardly know that I am here. They forced me to it much against my will, but they are strong and I am weak. How could I deny them since they put me here? After all," he concluded naively, "perhaps it is the will of le bon Dieu, and he knows best, my child. He knows best." The shoes evidently refused to respond any further to the old man's efforts at polishing them. He contemplated them now, with a whimsical look of regret on his furrowed face, then set them down on the floor and slipped his stockinged feet into them.
Marguerite was silently watching him, still leaning on her elbow. Evidently her brain was still numb and fatigued, for she did not seem able to grasp all that the old man had said. She smiled to herself, too, as she watched him. How could she look upon him as a jailer? He did not seem at all like a Jacobin or a terrorist. There was nothing of the dissatisfied democrat, of the snarling anarchist ready to lend his hand to any act of ferocity directed against a so-called aristocrat, about this pathetic little figure in the ragged soutane and worn shoes. He seemed singularly bashful, too, and ill at ease, and loath to meet Marguerite's great, ardent eyes which were fixed questioningly upon him. "You must forgive me, my daughter," he said shyly, "for concluding my toilet before you. I had hoped to be quite ready before you woke, but I had some trouble with my shoes. Except for a little water and soap, the prison authorities will not provide us poor captives with any means of cleanliness and tidiness, and le bon Dieu does love a tidy body as well as a clean soul. But there, there," he added fussily, "I must not continue to gossip like this. You would like to get up, I know, and refresh your face and hands with a little water. Oh, you will see how well I have thought it out. I need not interfere with you at all, and when you have made your little bit of toilette, you will feel quite alone, just as if the old man was not there." He began busying himself about the room, dragging the rickety, rush-bottomed chairs forward. There were four of these in the room, and he began forming a kind of bulwark with them, placing two side by side, then piling the two others up above. "You will see, my child, you will see," he kept repeating at intervals as the work of construction progressed. It was no easy matter, for he was of low stature, and his hands were unsteady from apparently uncontrollable nervousness. Marguerite, leaning slightly forward, her chin resting in her hand, was too puzzled and anxious to grasp the humour of this comical situation. She certainly did not understand. This old man had in some sort of way, and for a hitherto unexplained reason, been set as a guard over her. It was not an unusual device on the part of the inhuman wretches who now ruled France to add to the miseries and terrors of captivity, where a woman of refinement was concerned, the galling outrage of never leaving her alone for a moment. That peculiar form of mental torture, surely the invention of brains rendered mad by their own ferocious cruelty, was even now being inflicted on the hapless, dethroned Queen of France. Marguerite, in far-off England, had shuddered when she heard of it, and in her heart had prayed, as indeed every pure-minded woman did then, that proud, unfortunate Marie Antoinette might soon find release from such torments in death. There was evidently some similar intention with regard to Marguerite herself in the minds of those who now held her prisoner. But this old man seemed so feeble and so helpless, his very delicacy of thought as he built up a screen to divide the squalid room in two, proved him to be singularly inefficient for the task of a watchful jailer. When the four chairs appeared fairly steady, and in comparatively little danger of toppling, he dragged the palliasse forward and propped it up against the chairs. Finally, he drew the table along, which held the cracked ewer and basin, and placed it against this improvised partition. Then he surveyed the whole construction with evident gratification and delight. "There now," he said, turning a face beaming with satisfaction to Marguerite. "I can continue my prayers on the other side of the fortress. Oh, it is quite safe," he added, as with a fearsome hand he touched his engineering feet with gingerly pride. "And you will be quite private. Try and forget that the old abbé is in the room. He does not count. Really, he does not count. He has ceased to be of any moment these many months now that St. Joseph is closed, and he may no longer say mass." He was obviously prattling on in order to hide his nervous bashfulness. He ensconced himself behind his own finely constructed bulwark, drew a breviary from his pocket, and having found a narrow ledge on one of the chairs on which he could sit, without much danger of bringing the elaborate screen onto the top of his head, he soon became absorbed in his orisons. Marguerite watched him for a little while longer. He was evidently endeavouring to make her think that he had become oblivious of her presence, and his transparent little manoeuvres amused and puzzled her not a little. He looked so comical with his fussy and shy ways, yet withal so gentle and so kindly, that she felt completely reassured and quite calm. She tried to raise herself still further, and found the process astonishingly easy. Her limbs still ached, and the violent, intermittent pain in her head certainly made her feel sick and giddy at times, but otherwise she was not ill. She sat up on the palliasse, then put her feet to the ground, and presently walked up to the improvised dressing-room and bathed her face and hands. The rest had done her good.
and she felt quite capable of coordinating her thoughts, of moving about without too much pain, and of preparing herself both mentally and physically for the grave events which she knew must be imminent. While she busied herself with her toilet, her thoughts dwelt on the one all-absorbing theme. Percy was in Boulogne. He knew that she was here, in prison. He would reach her without fail. In fact, he might communicate with her at any moment now, and had without a doubt already evolved a plan of escape for her, more daring and ingenious than any which he had conceived hitherto. Therefore she must be ready and prepared for any eventuality. She must be strong and eager, in no way despondent, for if he were here, would he not chide her for her want of faith? By the time she had smoothed her hair and tidied her dress, Marguerite caught herself singing quite cheerfully to herself, so full of buoyant hope was she. End of chapter 18.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.